Hello guys, welcome to Blood Rituals. I'm your host, Nicole Fernandez. I just want to thank everybody for actually listening to this show because I saw on my account that a lot of people have been listening from Sweden and Germany for some reason. And I don't know how the hell you guys found me. And I don't know if it was by mistake or not, like if you just clicked on my thing and went away. But I just want to let you know that I sincerely enjoy the fact that you guys, in particular, are listening to me. Thank you, America, for listening to me as well. Every single person that listens means so much to me because it just feels nice to know that my thoughts are going out into the universe and they're being heard. I just want to apologize for the editing issues and whatnot for my other episodes and also for being so drunk on the first episode because I've realized now that even though I'm not proud of that episode, maybe I should keep it to remind myself never to act like that again. And consider this a lesson for you all, for all of you guys that want to get drunk and smoke before doing a podcast. Maybe it's not the best idea unless you're with friends, which I wasn't. I was just with my cat, which you could hear half the time. Anyway, I apologize for that as well. I do have a cat here and she's very needy and she screams a lot and I don't have a studio to record anything in or another place to go, mainly because of the quarantine, but I promise you guys, I will do my best to keep everything up to date and everything. I'm going to do my best to edit this as well as I can and I'm also trying new methods. I'm going to record this episode just full on a straight shot and if there's any issues, I'll go ahead and edit it out later, so it's better than me recording things in small segments, which I'm pretty sure you noticed on the last episode. Anyway, this isn't a professional podcast. I'm doing my best, so thank you for understanding. I do want to say something about the quarantine, though. I just hope that everybody's okay, and I hope that everybody has enough security and enough like emotional stability to carry themselves throughout this whole entire process because I know it's really hard to leave a job that you thought was secure all because of an illness that's been spread. It's completely unpredictable and I understand that everybody is scared and that everybody is scrambling to make sure that they're safe and healthy but also they have enough money to pay the bills. Excuse me. But I do believe that the whole, you know, the checks that are coming in with our taxes and whatnot, I forgot what they're called, but the reprieve money or whatever, just so we can pay our rent, I really do think that will help us all out just because having a month's rent is really useful. And outside of that, I do know that a lot of the laws regarding rent and mortgage and whatnot, I think it would just be helpful if you guys just check that out, even if you do pay like $50 a month, because any amount of money helps. But let's go ahead and jump into today's subject, which is the creation myth whenever it comes to Shinto practice in Japan. But before we get into that, I do want to touch on a few things, such as why should we even study this? So why should we even study the roots of Shinto if it's not necessarily current or accurate right now? Well, the roots of Shinto are medieval, and it was Fabio Rambelli, somebody that has a PhD in East Asian studies from the University of Venice and the Italian Ministry of Scientific Research. He's very impressive. You can look him up. He has plenty of studies done, and he's written a couple books. And he's also a professor of religious studies, cultural studies, and Japanese religions. However, he wrote in a piece called Repositioning the Gods, Medieval Shinto and the Origins of Non-Buddhist Discourses on the Kami. Kami is just a fancy word in Japan for gods. In medieval Japan, there was no unified discourse on the Kami. And that's something that we should keep in mind throughout this presentation is that
There is not a direct order of the way these gods were created in any text. And just like Christianity has many variations of their texts and also like little cults that spun out from Christianity, the Shinto religion is very similar to Christianity in that aspect, not necessarily any other aspect, besides the fact that there's gods and mythology and whatnot. I'm sure there's different correlations that we can make at this point in time, but I'm not going to because I don't know everything in the whole entire fucking world because I'm not a super genius. I'm sorry, people. But I do know that I have a little information on the roots of Shinto in this podcast and also a little cult that we can explore. So let's just go ahead and jump right in because I don't see any point in waiting anymore. Whenever it comes to medieval Shinto, though, we have to utilize the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki, which is also called the Nihongi. Nihongi! And we had to read basically these weird websites that did not translate Japanese to English really well whatsoever. And it, to say the least, like my best friend Justin did his best to find this book basically anywhere. He's the one that helped me research most of this information. And we just couldn't find a version of the Kojiki that was perfectly in English, nor could we find the Nihongi in that manner. Unless we like went out and physically bought a copy, which we would still need to get it translated. And also, we don't really have the money to buy an actual copy right this second. So we just have to do with what we can. I hope that doesn't bother you, but even if this is all really hard to make sense of, I got a kick out of reading the Kojiki because I sounded like somebody on 4th Street once I read it out loud to my friends on Google Hangouts. And it was really fun. Just realizing how vastly horrible Google Translate really is. Anyways, the Kojiki is the oldest book in Japan's history. That's why we went back to this, because they have a list of the line of descent in Japan, the creation of gods and the earth, as well as different mythological creatures such as yokai and yuri, which we already know a little bit about if you listened to last episode. Yokai and yuri originated from this book because whenever this book was made, it was a documentation of absolutely everything Japan cared about at the time. And like I said, it established descent, like royal descent, but it also linked history to everything in there as well, which is fascinating. I believe that we have a lot of different records like that, and the Egyptians had a lot of records like that, and the Sumerians. So it's fascinating to see that Japan does the same thing, and they protect their words as much as they can. Because even to this day, the Kojiki is respected, and even though a lot of people don't follow it, same with the Nihongi, they do respect the way that it shaped their culture. And all these myths tie together with other myths later on, so it's important to study. Anyways, the Kojiki is the oldest book, and it follows the genealogy of the early emperors until Empress Seoku in 628 CE. And like the time difference is really huge, obviously, but that was the best that they could do. And moreover, the Nihongi, it's the second oldest compilation of ancient myths in history. However, it retells the myths and kind of reshapes them in a way. And most facts about descent and major historical events in Japan are written from the perspective of the culture at that time. So whenever it comes to the culture and the history of Japan at that time, the Kojiki isn't necessarily ruled out or seen as, I guess, inaccurate, but in a way, it seems like they just need to update what's going on in their text. Just like I was explaining to one of my friends about Mormonism, it's just like, if there's a point in your religion where you start not believing certain things, you do evolve and change those beliefs to match what your new train of thought is. Not necessarily the individual, but if the entire culture comes together and finds that this is necessary. That's how the Nihongi comes into fruition. It's basically that the Kojiki seemed so outdated, they needed to make another one that was a lot more accurate based on what they believed in at that time instead of when the Kojiki was originally made. Anyway, so based on that, we did our best to tell the version of creation by blending what the Kojiki and the Nihongi had in common for the most part, but also what we found online to be the most relevant and what is discussed around Japanese culture as of right now. Even though these are beliefs that have been passed on from literally 700, the year 700 or so, it's quite common to, you know, like I said, just evolve in that thought process. So this is how the story of creation all starts. Oh, and I do want to mention, if anybody wants to see any of the sources that we looked at, feel free to email me. My email is listed in the podcast description, and I'm always available to talk, and I'm always willing to listen to any suggestions or comments, concerns, but I will definitely be able to give you the sources for this podcast if you need it. The story of creation. So, the universe. It was a shapeless kind of matter. It was sunken in silence, and everything was still for a long period of time. And then, just imagine. Little noises. Just all building on each other, compounding. All bringing all sorts of sounds that were just now coming into fruition. And this was all caused by movement. They believe that there was just some random movement that made the particles just move in space and the shapeless mass that was the universe. Which makes sense because I don't really know what caused that movement. However, that's basically just... It's very common for like creation beliefs to have this sort of a vague introduction to everything. However, the way that they lay this out is so beautiful. The lightest particles rose to the top of the universe, dispersing the heaviest particles to what was known to be Earth. The light was at the top of the universe, meaning the lightest particles, quote unquote, as in holy or genuine, also just godlike. And then the clouds of heaven were created from the lightest particles going up to the top. And that is called Takamagahara. That is heaven. And particles were dispersed evenly. The heaviest particles sank to the bottom of this big ass ball of shit, which we really do call Earth. And they really believed, since this was obviously written in like 720, it was 900 years before Galileo was sentenced for believing the sun was the center of the universe in 1633. So the imagery is magnificent. The actual logic behind it, it does make sense philosophically for the time period. So it all just, and the spirituality surrounding all of their ideas is so amazing. Just the fact that everything is not really animated, but considering they believe in animism above anything else, blows my mind because I just wish that I had enough spiritual, I don't really know. Like, I wish I believed in something that big besides witchcraft and whatnot to where I can just like really believe that a cup or my doorknob or the TV or even this candle right here have a living force inside of them. Anyway, that's not the point. I just believe that this is just an amazing fucking story and you're about to see why, because right now is when we get into the actual creation of the gods. The creation of the the creation of The Koto Matsukami, or the Heavenly Kami, is probably one of the most central things in this story, just because we're going to move through what we call the Hidarigami, which are basically deities that have no gender or partner. They're like separate heavenly kami, as opposed to like having a partner. And the reason why we're going to go into these is because Hidarigami create the ethereal realm of heavens and the earth. So they're gods that actually like set up everything on earth, like wind and trees and whatnot. However, these Hidarigami, these three in general, are the biggest ones that I've seen throughout all of the variations of the text I could find. And the Kojiki that I saw mentioned these three in particular as well. The order is not important, like we've discussed, but this is the order that I found that was most logical. So the first Hidarigami is called Ametokotachi. And Ametokotachi is known as the ever-standing heaven. And as soon as he came into being, it was said that his name refers to the tip of a reed thrusting skywards. Isn't that impressive? Thrusting skywards into the heavens. So Ametokotachi definitely fucked heaven for a while before making something beautiful. And that's what I love most about it. I can't say him or her because it's not a gender, but maybe they. And the coolest thing about this deity and all the other deities that are Hidarigami is that they conceal themselves afterwards. So they basically just sink into the foundation of the earth. So the second Hidarigami we're going to go over is Kunotokotachi. And Kunotokotachi stands for Everstanding Land. And he was born after Ametokotachi, or it was born after Ametokotachi, to show that Ametokotachi is superior to the other beings. And it also shows that heaven is superior. Maybe this is like an Adam and Eve situation where Ametokotachi is dominant just because it came first. Like, that honestly wouldn't surprise me, since many of our religious doctrines share this aspect of dominance being related to time, place, or gender. Anyway, yeah, couldn't find any logical reason as to why Kunotokotachi is inferior for any reason other than that in general. However, in a spiritual sense, I can respect that. Like, Ametokotachi is heaven, so if he needs to come about first so that the gods have a place to rest, then it does make sense. The third Hidarigami is named Umashia Shikabiha Koji. And that name means fine budding reed lad. And it's necessary to say that this name means from reed shoot, which grew after the separation of heaven and earth. Which is very important to note, because the separation of heaven and earth is the point in which the Hidarigami are finally settled, the ethereal realm is complete, and we can finally move forward and create the gods that take care of Earth and craft Earth's atmosphere instead of focusing on the stars and everything else like that. So the gods made Earth the way it is. This is literally all we cared about back in 721, like just the fucking Earth. We still have about 900 years to get to the outside of Earth. So there's a lot of hope for smarter, more considerate days ahead, not just for Japan, but for a whole dumbass world at this point. So this is the story of Earth. These two gods are named Izanagi and Izanami. Izanagi is the male companion, and then Izanami is the woman. These two gods were crafted to bring order to a world of chaos. And the way my friend Justin put it, this is defined as order through chaos. And this is because Izanagi and Izanami, they both had access to this spear named Amanunoboko. And it stirred the matter of the earth in a big cauldron, basically like witches over a brew of sloppy old humanity and the rest of the plants on the earth. Or like the doctor from Powerpuff Girls, how they just stirred in a bunch of shit. That's essentially how Izanagi and Izanami created the world. They are exact opposites. Izanagi is male, tall, strong. He's listed as saying he's strong as a willow. And Izanami, she is obviously the exact opposite in the sense that she's delicate in a manner of speech and respect. So she's just all around pure-hearted and sweet and golden, while Izanagi is known for being, the strong part of their couple. He's like the dominant figure in this couple. So from here, they stirred and stirred until they lifted up the Amanonobuko. Sorry, excuse my pronunciation. But they stirred the stick until everything seemed like they stirred the stick until the ocean seemed at ease, I believe it was. I can't remember exactly when they stopped, but once they lifted Amanonobuko, one single drop of the ocean fell, and that one drop of matter, it wasn't necessarily the ocean, but it was matter that fell from Amanonobuko. It created Onokoro, which is where Izanagi and Izanami took residence for the first time. And honestly, I just think it's really cool how the Japanese took comfort in the fact that Earth was just a big fancy bowl of soup before Izanagi and Izanami did the whole Mary Poppins thing where they jumped to the bowl and it became the world. Like, I don't know if they actually jumped into anything, but in my head, they did, because there's no clarification as to how they brewed this or why they did this in a big-ass cauldron, or if the cauldron even disappeared, what it was. I don't know what they were stirring, but it's possible that the quote-unquote cauldron was just Earth and they were up in the heavens. That's what it seems to me, is that the stick was just, astronomically long. That's what she said. Anyway, they made other islands as soon as they started inhabiting Onokoro, because as soon as it was made, that's when their descent happened. Because whenever it comes to these gods, it's not like they just hang out and play for the most part. They are always creating, especially in the beginning of time. This whole entire period is just work, work, work. Like, imagine Izanagi and Izanami at Amazon.com, the warehouse. Like, basically, instead of just being little production associates by themselves, Izanagi and Izanami are equivalent to being not just Amazon, but being every single company associated with Amazon, every single company that associates their, like, shipping materials and whatnot. They are what the world is. And without them, there would be no world, apparently. And that's why Onokoro is so legendary, because that was the very first island, according to their origin story. And they did this. They came down to Earth. And the whole reason they wanted to come to Earth was not just to be, not just to be solidified as creators, but they also wanted to get married. At this point, Izanagi and Izanami, they are, sister and brother in a sense, but they are gods. So they aren't necessarily thinking about themselves as brother and sister. They're more of husband and wife, and they want to become husband and wife because they've created such a close bond over creating what the future is supposed to be soon. And it's right in front of them. The other gods that are before them, like the Hitorigami and the other gods that are in pairs, because Izanagi and Izanami aren't the only paired gods that were created. It was known that there is a ritual that they need to do in order to get married, which basically means the man and the woman run in opposite directions, reaching each quote-unquote pillar or column that line every single corner of the world. And once they pass every column in the opposite direction and meet up with each other at the very end, that's when they have the capability to actually move forward and do the marriage ceremony and start creating other gods. And they can't create other gods until they're married. That's the most important part. And not just married, they need to be married properly. So they come down to Earth. They do their whole fucking thing where they run around the Earth like, you know, the balloon races from that one Disney movie with Jackie Chan. And then they end up meeting together. And they were overjoyed to meet each other. They were freaking running around the world as fast as they could to meet up with each other as quickly as possible. That's what the story says, is that they were so anxious to get back together that they just raced to each other. And they were so overjoyed that Izanami overzealously just started telling her, started telling Izanagi, I love you, you're so beautiful, you're so handsome, all of this stuff. And Izanagi returned the sentiment, obviously, but there was a hint of disappointment in his tone. Almost like he knew that the marriage was going to be doomed for some reason. Like, he just had a bad premonition, but he didn't know what the actual premonition was. It was sort of like a feeling, like, something is gonna go wrong, and I'm not exactly sure why. However, once they end up doing the actual marriage ceremony, they obviously become husband and wife, but this is at the expense of eternal joy. So there's one version where Izanagi tells Izanami that it was bad luck for a woman to speak first, and he is not sure why, type of thing. And then another version, they're completely unaware of any ill fortune whatsoever, and Izanagi isn't upset. Izanami's completely cool, and they end up getting married. But just to let you know, no matter what version of the Izanagi and Izanami story, their love does not have a chance to last. It does not have a chance. So this story starts with the creation of the Awaji Island and then Hiruko, which is the first daughter that Izanagi and Izanami have together. So the first character in Hiruko's name literally means leech. And some say that she actually looked like a leech, but others say that this signifies just not being fully formed as a human being yet, or a god. In any shape or form, it was described that Hiruko was weak and boneless, but also, like I said, somewhat looked leech-like. Like, basically, just imagine a god giving birth to a slug. Like, that is what Hiruko was, which is super sad, because they end up putting Hiruko on a boat made out of reeds and whatnot and just sailing the child out into the sea and forgetting about it. And the desertion of Hiruko might seem cruel right away. However, this is sort of the first example of human callousness towards genetic diversity that's seen in this text, I believe. However, even if that was the case originally, Japan changed the story of Hiruko's ultimate significance, because Japan found a lot of compassion for Hiruko. This one poet from the 10th century named Ono Asatsuna, said, "Such immense grief these parents felt to see legs still unformed enough to stand after 3 years." I'm not sure where the 3 years thing came from. However, I do want to say that some people blended Hiruko's story in the 14th century with the kami of the sea named Ibisu, basically saying that they're the same deity. Others say they found one another, as in Ibisu was fishing in the sea and then caught Hiruko like a little fish because Hiruko was just in the water. But most say that Hiruko washes up on shore, probably a piece of Japan that no longer exists. Not just probably, that's what most of the legends say, that it's an actual piece of land that does not exist anymore. And Hiruko is always regarded as an endearing figure because she brings good luck. All due to the fact that Hiruko is a child and it died under really sad circumstances, just being genetically, like, not being developed correctly. And there's a huge, huge, huge conspiracy wrapped around a second child that Izanagi and Izanami gave birth to. And I've been yelling this to every single person in my Google Hangouts chat, a grand total of two people that I've been screaming at, and still nobody really knows what the fuck is up with this second child named Awashima. Not just like nobody in the whole entire world, but in my group of friends. So I am going to make it my duty to make sure that you know what the fuck this child is about, because the child's name is Awashima. Awashima is also a daughter of Izanagi and Izanami. However, the history behind Awashima is what crafts the cult that I was trying to reference earlier, because even though Izanagi and Izanami are central and Hiruko is in every single story, Awashima only appears in a small fraction of any of the Kojikis and the Nihongi. So there is a chance that Izanami and Izanagi had a second deformed child before consulting the gods about their concerns about Hiroku. Their plan was to go straight to heaven, talk to them about Hiroku, and let them know that, hey, our child was born deformed. Did we do something wrong? Was the marriage ceremony not done properly? However, this goes along the same track where Izanagi and Izanami didn't know what was wrong. And if this is the tale where Izanagi was secretly feeling as if something was going wrong, these tales all excuse those fears and doubts, and they just move on and have another child instead, basically to test the belief or to test their actual ability to have children, whether or not it was just a fluke. So I got a lot of information about Awashima from a woman named Rebecca Harmon. She's a Japanese translator and interpreter who studied Japan studies from 2003 to 2008 at four different universities, at Vanderbilt, Tokyo International University, Willamette, and I think the University of Washington. However, she worked as an assistant manager for internal operations for one of the Japanese companies for almost 7 years, and she translated and interpreted English all day, every day. She has a whole entire website called yokaigrove.com. I would highly recommend looking into that, because that whole website is based on her academic research whenever it comes to yokai and to kami and the origin stories whenever it comes to Japan in general. All of her credentials are listed on LinkedIn. And even though I can't completely edify her because I don't know her, I do want to say that I reached out to this woman over email because there were a lot of things that were confusing me, because for a period of time I was starting to believe that Awashima was just something that she made up. However, she actually emailed all of her sources to me, so I have a list of those here with me now, and it was extremely helpful because all of those websites were in Japanese. And from what she says, if you look up Awashima, a lot of the English websites that have Awashima revolve around tourism, so you won't get a lot of historical information or mythological information. Anyway, so without her, I'd be going insane. So thank you, Rebecca Harmon. I don't think you'll ever listen to this, but fucking thank you. Anyway, the first story of Awashima comes from Yokai Grove, and that is the story where Awashima is the second child of Izanagi and Izanami. So the child's deficiency was only stated as not very good. That's it. So in a very euphemism sort of way, all they say is she came out fucked up, paper arms, glass legs, and then Awashima was not counted among their children. That's what was directly quoted from the Nihonga. Awashima was not counted among their children. So there's no information outside of that. And if you look at the Yokai Grove page about, I believe it's called The Unbeloved, it has a bunch of information about Awashima and Hiruko. So I highly recommend looking at those web pages if you're a little more curious about what they say. However, I'm doing my best to give you all the information from the website itself. Just these direct quotations are on that page if you want to take a look. So the second story of Awashima is surrounded around Awashima's pronunciation being Awashima-sama, which means that she was the wife god of Sumiyoshi Mihoen. And Mihoen, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but in Japanese it just means shining, illuminating, or apparent deity. And the cultic belief behind Sumiyoshi Mihoen is related to the stories from the text Yokyo, or Yokyoku, which means the no script. It's the religious doctrine surrounding this god, or actually Sumiyoshi is involved in a triad of gods. I'm not exactly sure their whole history. I just know more about Awashima whenever it comes to this. But what's important to know is that Sumiyoshi was a god that gave the universe guardianship over, this god had guardianship over safe sea travel, but he also gave classical poetry, and he was the god of agriculture and fishing. And the classical poetry that they call, classical poetry in Japan is called waka poetry. And it's been known that this type of poetry is connected to the gods in many ways. I'm not exactly sure how, but that's what I've read so far, that this poetry is directly linked to the ancient desire to be connected with the gods more. And this was the best way whenever it came to Sumiyoshi. So shortly after marriage, Awashima-sama suffered a disease in her reproductive organs, and she was exiled for this and swept to the island of Awashima. And there she became the guardian deity of women, but she was banned to this island basically because of an illness that she didn't knowingly contract or anything like that. She just fucking had it. And that's the scariest thing, is like, at this point in time, can you imagine just being a woman god, just hanging out, you get married, and then you contract a disease? Like, I'm not sure how that's possible, but like, are gods even allowed to get STDs? That's something we should put on a forum, because I really don't think that's right. You know what? I'll just leave that open to you guys. If you feel like it's okay to be, if you think it's logical for a god to get an STD, please let me know. And if so, please give me your train of thought, because I would really like to get inside your head and understand what the fuck that's like. Anyway, she was banned to an island called Awashima, and Awashima-sama made a doll that she released into the ocean, and tied to this doll was her illness symbolically. This is a practice known as Nagashibina, which is just a doll floating. That's what it means in Japanese. This is a practice that's been going on as early as the Heian era, and women used paper and straw dolls as holy objects, as well as underwear, just normal things that they attach to themselves that they're willing to let go. That's very personal. In a way, these items are considered yokai because they're alive and they're attached to the being that wants to get rid of a certain energy, or even if they're just worshiping Awashima, releasing an item into the river isn't necessarily less symbolic than letting a doll into the river. It's just the practice of actually using a doll that's historic because of this story. And the practice of, Nagashibina is still used to this day. There's a festival every year on March 3rd, a holiday that's absorbed by the whole entire country, basically. And it incorporates the practice where dolls carry illnesses or sins of the women who made them. And even if the dolls are universally used, they recognize stereotypically that they're supposed to help vaginal and uterine problems. But people still visit these temples in order to give praise to Awashima for the sake of just giving luck to women in general, or giving a woman who's worshiping some sort of guidance. The Girls' Day is usually dedicated to younger women because younger women take pleasure in making these dolls and going about this tradition more than maybe the older women do. However, it is something that everybody practices It's just a family bonding type of situation as well. Anyways, back to Awashima. So Awashima then makes a doll, releases it into the ocean to rid herself of the illnesses. And it's unclear whether or not her symptoms actually subsided. But either way, she's still worshipped on the island of Awashima wholeheartedly. However, there are shrines everywhere for her. The most important one is in the Wakayama Prefecture. And in this shrine, there's just like hundreds of dolls. And it's not just dolls or figurines, but like I said earlier, a lot of women leave their underwear in order to bring about good luck and health, rejuvenation in their lady organs. And I do have a small YouTube clip that I want to add into this whole thing, just because this lady does a good job explaining the scene of this shrine.
There is another custom practiced here at this shrine. Since there is a deity or god or spirit, however you prefer to call it, that takes care of women, here women come and donate their panties to the god of the shrine, to the deity of the shrine. And this is actually this place where they donated. They used to actually display it, but right now people don't display it anymore because there have been some thieves actually stealing the panties. So what most people do now is they pack it up and then they throw it through one of those grids. So women here donate their underwear, so that could be their panties, that could be maybe their bras, and they donate it here and say they have to be used. Probably washed afterwards, but you kind of donate them to say thank you, or do you donate them for the deity of this place to take care of you? So, for example, women who have had breast cancer or have breast cancer might donate their bras here and such. So it's actually, I know it sounds, in the first place, it sounds funny, but at the same time, it's actually very connected to this god who's supposed to take care of women and keep them healthy and happy. And so I brought two of my knickers and I wrapped them up nicely in my little fishy pouch here to donate them to keep me healthy, to keep my female areas healthy. And I asked, why underwear? And I heard one saying is that this is the closest to the female, the expression of the female, yeah, to your sex or your gender or to the breasts as such.
Well, I'm really fucking happy that she put her underwear in a fishy pouch, because that's really fucking funny. But I think you get the gist. This woman's just basically relaying to you that all these different things are related to women and related to health whenever it comes to women, because this deity is completely for women, and that's about it. And that's why the doll festival and everything like that are prevalent, because in Japan, mainly in Awashima, this isn't necessarily seen as cultish. This is kind of typical behavior for the Japanese culture. Ancient religions are practiced all over the world in small groups, and even though it doesn't really mean that they're huge religions, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're cults. They have cult-like activity that people refer to in text and whenever they try to describe these sorts of things, whenever it comes to Awashima and the legend surrounding the marriage with Sumiyoshi. Cults in Japan are known to act in accordance to Shinto and Buddhist guidelines anyway. So their presence in society is not as harmful as other cults have been, such as Aum Shinrikyo, which is literally a cult from the 80s that focused on luring geeks into a commune to build bombs and shit to prepare for an Armageddon. And clearly, this whole quote-unquote cult activity is only because this is a god that recognizes just women, and that's it. And the other god that she was married to worshipped the sea, agriculture, and fish. And that's a huge belief whenever it comes to Japanese people, because most of their food is from the ocean and they live in the ocean. Like, their entire country is an island, and most of Japan branches off into little islands as well. Excuse me, not most of it, but there's a big chunk that branches off into little islands. So I just wanted to let you guys know that even though Awashima is not technically a cult, it's considered a cult. And the doll ceremony just seems like a cool way to celebrate what's going on with my ovaries and every other ovary in the world. It just seems like a really cool place to go. And I'm really happy that I found out that Awashima's legend is so minute and hidden, because that just means that this story isn't necessarily known by many Americans anyway. Like, the origin story of how the world and the universe came about for Japan, that is somewhat well known for people that study Japan on their own. This minute fun story, you just wouldn't have found if you didn't really go deep into the Japanese web like I had to do. So imagine that Awashima is a part of the story. Imagine that she's not a part of the story. Either way, we can move on successfully onto the next part, which is basically whenever Izanagi and Izanami go to heaven to ask their elders for help. They don't necessarily understand what's going on. Awashima was fucked up, and so was Hiruko. So the god said, okay, well, the problem is, you clearly spoke first, Izanami, so shut your face, redo this marriage ceremony, and let your husband call you pretty first. Like, god damn it, just let your husband talk first. And they did, and they were finally able to give birth to other gods just because Izanami let Izanagi establish dominance in the relationship by speaking first during the ceremony. This is a, you know, religious thing that we kind of talked about earlier that's seen in many other religions. It's sort of a pattern where there's precedence at some point. However, whatever, we can't do anything about it. It's a part of the story and it's a part of our fucking, like, world. So we just got to deal with our origins, whether we like it or not. These gods were made to preside over the land, sea, mountains, rivers, trees, and herbs. And their first successful born proved to be the sea god. And his name was Owatatsumi no Kami. And then they gave birth to the patron god of arbors, the male deity named Kamihawa Akitsu Hiko. So Kamihawa Akitsu Hiko. And this male deity had control of the land, just complete control of the land. Goddess Haya Akitsu Him had control of the sea as well. Kamihawa Akitsa Hiko and Haya Akitsu Haim decided to get busy and make 8 other gods together. So there are a bunch of other gods I don't really know about, but I did see that they created 8 other gods as soon as Izanami and Izanagi gave birth to them. The wind deity, Kamishina Tsuhiko no Mikoto. There's a quote that I wanted to give you, because this wind deity obviously just makes wind, but it was said that at the moment of his birth, his breath was so potent that the clouds and the mists which had hung over the earth from the beginning of time were immediately dispersed. In consequence, every corner of the world was filled with brightness. And I think that's lovely. Without wind, how would those dumbass particles move anywhere? I'm not exactly sure how that stick spun around the particles enough to where it was, like, sitting well. And I'm not sure if the wind deity kind of just, like, blew around what they couldn't sit, like, together. But I just don't know. Like, I guess Izanagi and Izanami are gods, but they're not strong enough to just, like, make the world settled on its own. So they have to create these extra deities to help them out. And it makes sense, because the Hidarigami are more ethereal. They're more like the essence of the actual, like, plane of everything. While these sorts of gods have more, they have more choice, but they also have to follow some sort of line of logic. They have to create things in order. Sort of how I just listed certain things being listed in order, like the sea god, like there being a god to watch over the sea, first of all, because that's what there is mostly. And then somebody to take care of the land, because that's what comes after the sea. There's like 70% of the whole entire world right now that's full of water. I can't even imagine back then when it was just Japan. And anyway, Kukochi no Kami, that was the next deity that was born. That was the deity of trees. And he was followed by the deity of mountains, Oyamatsumi no Kami. And then, God, I just suck at this, but the next one was the Goddess of Plains. And by then, they realized that they needed to give birth to a fire god. That's when tragedy struck, because Izanami gave birth to the fire god Kagutsuchi. And it scorched her vagina all the way up to her fucking brain. Like, the birth of this fire god completely, it just engorged her in flames, and it consumed her soul and every part of her essence and sent her straight to Yami. And Yami is not heaven or hell. It's just the land of the dead, or a world of darkness. Once you get to this world, if you end up eating in Yami, it's impossible to return to the land of the living. Mostly. There are parentheses around mostly whenever I see most of these articles. So I don't know if it's a Dante's Inferno type of thing, or one of those things where, like Sabrina going back and saving her boyfriend in The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. Stuff like that. It seems like is influenced by Yami's culture, or excuse me, Yami's historical significance. In another version of this birth, Izanami was burned during birth, obviously, but then she fell to the ground, and from her death, a bunch of gods were born, including earth and water goddesses. And then Izanagi's tears, as he cried over his lover, created more deities as well. And he ended up slicing up Kagutsuchi with a sword in anger. And then Kagutsuchi's chunks of flesh all became gods. It was basically like Izanagi sliced up his fire son, and he just kept living, and he created multiple entities that were all gods based on his chunks. And the same fire god's splattered blood is what formed the stars of the Milky Way. It's just very beautiful to think that somebody's blood is what shines in the sky right now. So Izanagi went to Yami to actually rescue Izanami. And the legend says that he smelled something rotting whenever he got to Yami. And then he followed the smell. He traced the smell to a particular location that had a dark room where Izanami was just sleeping on a pallet. And the only reason he knew that it was Izanami was because his intuition told him so. And they spoke. He confirmed that it was her. And he just asked her if he could bring her back to Earth again. And she said that she ate the dark food of Yami, so it was impossible for her to return to the living. Instead of going back to the living together, she pleaded for him to stay there in Yami. And he said he couldn't. And he lit a torch so he could find his way out. But as soon as he did that, he brought it to her face just to say goodbye. And the moment he did that, he realized that the body was that of a corpse. And around her head and breast were 8 demons of thunder. And, you know, imagine a fucking demon of thunder. It's just like some dude clapping or like opening their mouth and all you hear is thunder. So it's just fucking loud in there. And I'm not sure if the fire itself is what brought attention to these demons, or if these demons were possibly just sleeping around her. However, whenever Izanagi panicked and ran out of the room, just fucking horrified at this scene, because it was basically like the lady from The Shining coming out of the bathtub, but it was his wife, and it was just not something he was expecting. So he dropped the torch, started setting fire to everything, but Izanami tried to stop Izanagi from actually leaving, and he chased him down, sent other spirits to capture him, and once he reached the entrance to Yami, he placed a stone across the actual dividing line from Earth and Yami. And this stone, this action in itself, it sealed in Izanami, and then it broke their union. And it created a barrier between the world and the living. He created a barrier between the world and living and dead with a huge boulder. He basically just like put a door over the actual entrance to Yami with a huge boulder, and it was heavy enough to where he could move it, but obviously Izanami couldn't, because Izanami was the complete opposite of him and did not have that sort of strength. He officially announced that he would divorce his wife, just like Michael Scott did whenever he announced that he was bankrupt. He literally just yelled it out into the world, and because they're gods, Izanami knew what the fuck was going on. Izanami protested, saying that she would take 1,000 of the living each and every day if he divorced her. That's scary shit right there. If you ever get married to somebody like that, fucking don't stay. And don't make the same mistake as Izanagi, because all Izanagi said in reply to that was, you know what? I'll give life to 1,500 each day if you do that. And because of that spiteful comment, that was when death was introduced into the world, officially, for humanity at least. There was no real, true, defined moment of violent death in this creation story until this moment, when Izanami and Izanagi agreed that they're not going to be together, but Izanami is welcome to kill 1,000 people each day. And if Izanagi keeps giving birth to 1,500 a day, it balances out in their mind for some reason. The idea of death was introduced to the world, obviously because of this, but the ideology of divorce was also introduced because of this, because this was the first divorce that we had seen in the creation story, or really in mythology, whenever it comes to Japan. And it's because Izanagi and Izanami, like I said earlier, just were not destined to be together, but they were destined to create these sort of parallels and to create Earth together, as well as to separate Earth from Hell. That was their main purpose in the end, no matter how sad it is. So it's said that Izanagi's life-giving fuels mankind to this day, and Izanami continues to slaughter people every day as well. Whenever this whole conversation was over and Izanagi felt at peace, he ended up washing off the taint of Yami in a river. And as he bathed, the goddess Amaterasu, that's what it is. The goddess Amaterasu, like tiramisu almost, came from his left eye. And then Tsukiyomi came from his right eye. And then the god of Susanoo came from his nose, the god of restless seas. Susanoo later complained about his role as a god. I didn't mention what the fuck the other two goddesses were because they don't really complain. But Susanoo later complained about his role as a god. And Susanoo was banished by Izanagi to Yami. But this was willingly. And after Susanoo went away, Izanagi wanted to retire as a god. He was just done creating. And, you know, I kind of think this is what happened with like a lot of gods and a lot of different religions. Maybe that's why a lot of shit goes downhill, because they just want to like take a break instead of just being what they were supposed to be, which is gods. Or yeah, you know what I mean. Anyway, just a little lazy. Izanagi just got a little tired. And some accounts of the myth say that Izanagi returned to the heavens, the high heavens. But others say that he rested on the island of Honshu. But Izanagi is still worshipped to this day. Maybe not by everyone, but Izanagi and Izanami are both largely recognized as the origin story of Japan. So worship of both these figures is not uncommon, and it's also not strange to do. And now, now that I presented my version of the story, I want to go over Justin's version, because even though I pulled a lot of my information from what he gave me, we both saw the story differently, and I thought it would be nice if I introduced his perspective, because it might be something that you appreciate more. I don't know, but I appreciate both, and I think it's worthy to note at least, and I think that you'll enjoy it as well, because I loved it. The creation of the world and all of that stuff was still the same, all the way up to what he refers to as the bad omen, or what several websites also refer to as the bad omen, which was what happened with Kiruko. And because it was weak and boneless, this was taken as an evil omen from like heaven, basically. And after consulting the gods and whatnot, Izanami floated her firstborn into the sea. And the omen occurred literally only because Izanami talked first when they met. This taught culture that man takes precedence over women because it pleases the highest kami. And this is the reason why Izanagi and Izanami lacked joy for one another, because this time when they met again, there was a sense of unity, but with obligation. So they created islands, they started to populate them, but they did not share the love mentioned in the previous versions that I found. It was more like, okay, we did this wrong and now we're fucked. We need to just make children and get it over with. This isn't about love anymore. This is about the fact that we need to keep creating. So whenever it comes to the death of Izanami, none of their children represented fire yet. So the birth of this being was one of the most dramatic points in their relationship, but it was also what kind of solidified their place in the universe, because even though Izanami died, her number one role in the world was to give birth to gods that needed to be here. And the god of fire ended up getting chopped into pieces whenever he killed his mother by Izanagi. And obviously, like I said, the god of fire got split up into different beings and different deities as well. So whenever Izanagi went down to get Yami, it wasn't because he was sad that his wife had died. Izanagi was sorrowing after the death of his sister wife. He was just sad about the fact that somebody that he was connected with since the beginning of their time on Earth had just fallen to the underworld. And he wanted to travel to Yami and meet Izanami and at least talk to her face to face about this. And as soon as he gets there, she said that she ate the fruit of the underworld. And right then and there, Izanami went out to beg the Lord of the Underworld to let her go back with Izanagi. And beforehand, she made Izanami promise that he would wait for her and not go into her room, just to stand in this hallway of, you know, whatever palace is in the underworld and wait for her to come back. What seems like ages go by before Izanagi starts smelling like a deathly stench. And because of this stench and because of how much time has passed, he completely forgot about the promise that he made, because he wanted to investigate. He wanted to make sure that nothing was wrong. And he brought a torch from the hallway. And upon the investigation, he found the source of the stench. And it was coming from the body of Izanami that was rotting on a fucking plate in the middle of the goddamn room. It was, like I said before, it was basically like the lady from The Shining. She had all those demons around her. But because he came into that room immediately, that breaking the promise brought shame and a curse onto Izanagi. And this curse sent a group of females to hunt him down and to try and keep Izanagi in Yami with her. And barely escaping, Izanagi placed a boulder at the gateway between Yami and Earth. And then Izanami went to find him herself, but she couldn't find a way around the boulder because it was way too fucking heavy. Like, she couldn't find a way around it, and Izanagi proceeded to tell her, like, he already severed their marriage, he doesn't want to be with her, and right away, she retaliated. She was just like, whatever, I'm going to kill 1,000 of your people every day then, and it happened instantly. So, from that point on, Izanagi told her that he will bear 1,500 children every single day as well. So right then and there, whatever emotional bonds they had left were completely and officially severed. And the moment that happened, that was the moment that the bond between the heavens and earth were completely severed. Which is the very end of this story, but it brings us back to this philosophical question of, you know, why is there an important link to heaven and hell being separated? Like, why is there an important link to kami being separated by ethereal beings and actual beings that can manifest into not necessarily like personified gods, but more or less, why are there so many different levels whenever it comes to these beings? The answers are kind of unclear, but the best I could say is that every religion kind of follows a sort of structure, and regardless of the structure or the actual tales that are being crafted around that, The things that we learn most about religion are skills to cope with our everyday environment and to cope with the unknown. Like, just knowing that Earth is so different from what we imagine perfection to be is what gives us the opportunity to imagine something like that whenever it comes to heaven, or whenever it comes to, like, these sorts of tales where there are damaged children and you need to rectify that by having a proper ceremony. The concepts of death, redemption, and sacrifice are common themes throughout history and literature. For example, the Epic of Gilgamesh. I just finished that. That's the first thing that comes to mind, because in that tale, death is 100% central to its meaning. And it's because whenever Gilgamesh goes through his life, he's not necessarily dying every single time he comes to a crossroads. A piece of his personality dies only because the infantile piece of his mind is finally letting go and he's transforming into something new. And that death is basically just a way for him to be reborn. And to me, I believe that's what's so significant about this Japanese tale, is that there's no real retribution whenever it comes to Izanami. She's fucked and she has to just deal with her fate because of, like, her doing her job. And she didn't know that she would die if she gave birth to the fire god. All she was trying to do was do her job, and then she was kind of doomed. It's easier to understand that there needs to be a significant dramatic event for us to grasp a concept in our brain, such as Izanami being murdered by fire and being sent to hell. It's like, excuse me, not sent to hell, but sent to the underworld. And this action in itself, this dramatic event, is something that humans kind of latch onto, because otherwise, like, earlier, whenever everything was being told all calmly, like the creation of the universe, it's hard for me to even remember half of those gods' names, because the only ones that matter to Japan is the story for between Izanagi and Izanami after the introduction of the three Hitorigami. So, anyway, I just thought this was a very interesting topic, and so was everything with Awashima. This was all just burning 500 holes into my brain. Mainly because I just fucking love the fact that once the emotional bonds were severed between Izanagi and Izanami, that was when the bond between the heavens and the earth were severed. Because, like, there was just complete and open access to every single realm before that. And that's sort of like Japan's Garden of Eden. Like, the Garden of Eden was where the humans had a chance to actually be perfect. And I'm not even sure if Adam and Eve were completely human. I'm going to go in and actually research Christianity after all of this, because I'm starting to get very interested in the stories between Cain and Lilith. However, that small mythological piece is what gives us the opportunity to create yokai and yuri in all different levels of heaven and hell, because not only is there yuri, but there is actual hell, and that is called Jigoku. They basically have like eight rings of hell, like, and that's pretty obnoxious, because whenever it comes to the underworld, there's also a set of yokai twins that guard the entrance to hell. There are a few beings that, like, cross your path along the way to make sure, like, you're even worthy enough to be in hell, type of thing. So just understanding this story will help you understand a lot more Japanese mythology coming up in the next couple episodes, because after this, we're going to go into a lot more about the yokai, because there's a shit ton of information about the yokai. And now that we know about hell a little bit more, I also want to talk about the eight great circles of hell, and also the comparison between the Buddhist hell and Japanese hell, because Buddhist hell is referenced as well in some of these texts, but they have eight circles of hot hell and 8 circles of cold hell, and all different things, excuse me, all different creatures and monsters that hide in these things as well. So, anyway, I really hope that you guys enjoyed all of this. It kind of melted my brain a little bit, but I'm glad we got to it. And I'm really happy that, you know, everything outside of the coronavirus, it seems things are getting better between everybody as a community. I've seen a lot of people just reach out to help each other. Like my grandma is one of the few people in Reno that are sewing masks, like on mass, excuse me, in mass amounts for the hospitals and whatnot. So if you're doing that, I appreciate the hell out of you. I think that's so fucking amazing. And I hope that you keep on going, because my friend that lives in Boston, he works for a company that sells face masks, and we don't need the information from him to tell us this, but I thought that you might want to know that internationally, face masks are definitely depleting. So go ahead. If you have the urge or the tools to be able to make these masks, as well as the skills, go for it. And please, please don't feel like you're wasting your time, because every mask, even if it's like 10, really does count. So, and there are a lot of designs to help these masks be a little more comfortable for the nurses and whatnot too, with little special clips if you want to look that up online or on Facebook or whatever. But anyway, thank you guys so much again for listening to my show. And a lot of this information again was given to me by my friends Hunter and Justin. So thank you guys. I don't know if you're listening, but a fucking thank you. And, you know, I just hope you guys stay safe and have a great time while you're quarantined. And remember, if you give your panties to a shrine, wrap it up in a fishy bag.
And please, 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 check out the GoFundMe page that is on my Instagram, Geneacologist. It is spelled like Dean, like Ed Dean, ending with ecologist, like, you know, a gynecologist. This GoFundMe is based around my mom and helping her, because she needs a caretaker and we could really use all the help that we can get. So please share that page, donate yourself if you can, even a dollar helps, literally anything. I appreciate you guys so much.